Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
So I called the blog post the Emerging LP Playbook.
Because of that blog post, all of a sudden, LP started reaching out and they're like, oh my God, you must be super connected in the LP world. Let's chat. And all of a sudden I had deal flow and I built this network purely on this blog post. So got in tons of conversations after that. I start tracking all this and I probably had about 300 LPs in my kind of like Rolodex of people that I've chatted with at least once.
My guest today is David Zhou. Over a year ago, David wrote the Non-Obvious Emerging LP Playbook, which has become one of the best blog posts on the somewhat obscure world of limited partners, the money behind the venture capital industry. David is currently the head of investor relations at Alchemist, one of the top startup accelerators focused on enterprise startups. Prior to that, David was an investor at Berkeley's Skydeck Accelerator and led operations at OnDeck Angels Fellowship. He also hosts a fabulous podcast called Superclusters, focused on demystifying the world of limited partners. Today, I sat with David to talk about the world of emerging LPs, who they are, what motivates them, and how they choose what funds to invest in. Towards the end, we also talked about how to fundraise from emerging LPs from the perspective of an emerging VC manager. David offers a unique perspective on the world of venture capital, so I hope that you enjoy our conversation. David, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Excited to be here. It's been a long time in the making. You've been pitching me the studio for a while, and I'm like, all right, I can't wait to see it.
I think one of the things that stands out about you when I met you was this concept of emerging LPs. I remember actually that day when we were having lunch in this Korean restaurant, you first mentioned that concept, emerging LPs, and I was like, what the F is that idea? Because most people talk about emerging founders or emerging managers in the case of VCs. Once again, you were the first person I ever heard talking about this idea of emerging LPs. Interestingly, you come from a more like a startup investor background. You're very young, so it's usually LPs tend to be older.
I don't have enough whiskers on my beard yet. I don't have enough salt and pepper in my hair. None of that.
Exactly, which is usually the typical stereotypical image of an LP. So what made you so interested in the world of limited partners, in particular, what you call emerging LPs?
So I will be honest, there were two catalyzing moments in that. One of which is, so I LP'd into my first fund last year, and I knew I was going to invest in that person. Person's absolutely brilliant. He was going to give me exposure to a market that I had no exposure to in my own angel investing portfolio. And I was like, this guy's brilliant. He used to run BD at AngelList. I don't want to say too much about that because there are a lot of things that are still under wrap for him, but he's brilliant. He understands the Indian market better than anyone else. One thing before I chose to write a check of any kind was like, I would love to think like an institutional LP.
Okay.
I knew I was going to go in the rookie game. And one of the best learning pieces that I knew when I started angel investing is like, invest alongside people who are smarter than you, because they will, even if you're investing the same thing, they will think about it in frameworks and in angles that you would have never thought about. Right. And so I, like when I started my angel investing career, I always invested with people who were smarter than me. And I knew I wanted to do the same for LPs, even though I was kind of taking this risk, this gambit on my own first fund one and all that. At that point in time, I knew 3-4 LPs total, like that's it. And I hit them up and I was like, I want to do this thing. How should I be thinking about this? What questions should I be asking? All these kind of things. And on top of that, I was like, oh man, 3-4, if we learn a statistic, that's such a small sample size. So I'm going to ask all my favorite GP friends, and I'm going to ask them who their most helpful LP is, or the LP they have on speed dial is. And that's the person I want to get intro to. And so in the span of 2 months, I talked to 80 LPs.
Wow. This was before or after?
Before investing. I was like, I've got to get all, and he was taking his own sweet time and all that, right? He was midpoint through the fundraising process. He still had a while before he got to a close and all that. And they gave me so much great insights and advice. And I know preceding this conversation, you know, I think you took a little look back into the emerging LP playbook as well. And so spoiler alert, I wrote a blog post about it. And I went back to the ADLP and was like, hey, I love your insights. I would like to share this with the broader world because you've been so helpful to me. half of them were like, no. Like, don't include my name. Don't include my insights. It's proprietary. It was just for you. And a lot of things are compartmentalized in the world of LP. And
were these what you call emerging LPs?
Or no, these are all established. Like, okay, established institutional LPs, large family offices.
Yes, exactly.
And so I'll give you an example. Like, in terms of the established folks, their check sizes on the smaller end range from $1 to $10 million. On the larger end, range from $50 to $100 million. Minimum check size, right? So it's a whole different ballgame altogether. Yeah. And they're like, no, like I shared all this in confidence, so don't share with anyone else. Another half were like, I love that idea. You should totally like write the blog post, share my thoughts, but I would like to look at the blog post before you put it out there just because compliance and all that other stuff, right? 25% of that half were like, hey, you can share my insights, but don't share my name because just saves us the trouble of running it by compliance, right? You can anonymize myself, call me Dr. Seuss or something. Put that out there. To this day, it ends up being my best performing blog post on a topic I never thought was going to resonate with a larger crowd of individuals. Because it was shared in random communities. It was shared in like the Carnegie Mellon community, the TED Talks community. But to this day, it accounts for, and speaking of the power law and all that, it accounts for like, I think 50% of my blog's views. And
wow.
I know.
Just emerging that LP playbook.
Just that one. And every single day, it probably continues to bring in like probably like 200 or 300 views per like day, which is great for written content. Keep in mind, this is a 1,200...
It's very long.
12,000-word blog post. Like, by far, my longest one is as well. Anyways, that was one. I was like, okay, there is an appetite for this. Because of that blog post, all of a sudden...
You published that blog post a few months ago, was it?
No. Our audience can fact check us here, but I want to say it's around August 2022, September 2022. So a little over a year ago. And all of a sudden, LP started reaching out, and they're like, oh my God, you must be super connected in the LP world. Let's chat. And GP started reaching out thinking I'm some serial LP out there. And they're like, oh my God, you invest in emerging managers, would love to start chatting. And all of a sudden I had deal flow and I built this network purely on this blog post. Keep in mind, that was the year 2022 when podcasts and like TikTok short form content was going crazy. Who would have thought people would read a 12,000 word blog post, which might as well be a short story.
Yeah. Or short book.
Or short book. Right. And so... Anyways, I was like, this is fascinating. So got in tons of conversations after that. By the end of the year, like this is closer, like by the end of the year, I'll say like December, mid-December or so, I start tracking all this and I probably had about 300 LPs in my kind of like Rolodex of people that I've chatted with at least once. That was one precipitation moment. The other moment in which it happened and how so I called the blog post the Emerging LP Playbook. Emerging LP, those two words together were not by my own design. To be fair, they were actually designed. So this is while I was at OnDeck. And OnDeck, we went through a roller coaster of a ride. And I'm sure there's tons of stories in which I can share there. But it was actually this partnership. And I got to give this Andrew credit where credit is due. So Andrew Gluck at Irreverent VC, I think he was hosting an event for LPs. And we were chatting about he wanted to like target first-time LPs for this event that he wanted to host in New York. He wanted to partner with OnDeck, specifically OnDeck Angels about that. We ended up sponsoring the event. But he was the one in, I think, our second Zoom call or something. He was like, oh, I would like, I think for this event, I want to call these first time LPs emerging LPs. And I was like, that's such a good name. And so I stuck with that ever since. Until someone comes with me to me with a better name, a better nomenclature, better vernacular for what that is, I'm going to stick to the emerging LP. Anyways, long answer to your short question.
So raising a VC fund as an emerging manager has become increasingly harder in the last couple of years. So how would you describe the limited partner landscape today? Because I think like this notion of emerging LP happens in a very particular, let's say, moment in the world of venture where it's harder to raise a fund. But it's also been a lot of changes in the last 2 years. And there's also a lot of new players. I mean, the famous sovereign funds from Saudi Arabia and other countries are coming into the game. So there's a lot of dynamics playing right now in the world of venture. How would you describe it today?
I'm going to say a couple of things, and Enzo, keep me honest here and feel free to like ask follow-up questions. I will say if you're an LP now, if you put LP anywhere on your LinkedIn bio, resume, wherever it is, you are the hot girl guy on the block. Like, I don't know how many LPs out there, I doubt there's that many, but like, I don't know how many LPs out there have ever been prom king or prom queen. Like, they are effectively that. Everyone's looking at you. Everyone wants to talk to you. You're the cool person out there, for better or for worse. And if like, you know, things like, you know, we're back in a bull market, they may no longer be, but for now they are. So what happened, and I might rewind this a little bit to 2022, just to give context of where we are today. I was still at On Deck Angels at the time. And there were a number of our angel investors who realized that they made some not so great bets when it came to angel investing. It was a bull market. We had all invested in sky high valuations. And
we all went through that.
We all went through that, right? Like, yeah, I'm sure like everyone went through that. And a lot of them in it went when the economy crashed, right? FRB went down, SVB went down, and sorry, acronyms, First Republic Bank,
SBF.
And SBF, you know, all this came crashing down. And there are a multitude of reasons of why, right? But effectively everything came crashing down. And in that, angel investors realized, okay, I got my feet wet. My gateway drug into the venture world was angel investing during the pandemic, and I loved it. I loved working with founders. I love imparting, paying it forward, kind of like based on my industry knowledge. But I realized I may not be as good of a picker as I thought.
Interesting.
And instead are like, well, I still want to be involved in the startup world, but I'd rather pick good pickers than rely on my own picking ability.
Interesting. These are mostly high net worth individuals, I mean.
High net worth individuals, operator angels, execs at Fortune 500 companies, larger. These were the conversations in which I was.
I imagine the threshold. I mean, there's always this common advice in terms of, okay, if you want to start a new investing, let's say pick 10 or 20% or even less of your portfolio and dedicate that cash on 50K, 100K exclusively to angel investing, or could be more. I mean, that minimum threshold for becoming a LP is a bit.
It's a bit higher. So for context, for everyone who, for the uninitiated, if you want to invest in a fund one, fund two, usually the minimum check size to get in is about 100, 250K USD, US dollars, right? If you're angel investing for the first time, usually the minimum check size is 25K. If you're lower than that, you go on some angel list syndicate or something like that, right? Have people invested less than 25K for an angel investment? Sure, right? My first couple of angel investments, I kid you not, my first angel investment was $1,000, like $1,000.
Yeah, there are many 2,500 on 5K. But I think that's easier for us that we're already in the game. In
true,
a sense,
we were already
right?
in the game.
If you're totally new to the game, it's harder.
Exactly. If you don't have a relationship with the founder or the GP, you have to invest the minimum check size. Unless for some reason the GP just like loves you and needs you for some random reason, right? And it could be many reasons. It could be your expertise, could be how you think about things, could be your connection to other LPs and all that. It could be all that. But it's also spread across capital calls, right? So when you invest a 100K check into a fund per se, you're not investing $100,000 all at once. It's not like investing to a startup where you give all that money all at once. You do it over a series of capital calls. Usually capital calls are every 6 months, and it's some proportion of the money you allocated. So for example, on average, it's like 20% every 6 months. So that means every half year, if you're investing 100K check, you're putting in 20K every 6 months. So you're allocating effectively, you know, that often. In a way you can think about it as like, angel check size just consistently across like 2.5-3 years kind of thing. Anyways, that's high net worth individuals. On the flip side, I started talking to a lot of family offices. They started reaching out after the blog post and they're like, holy cow, we are over indexed. So there are two sides. They're emerging family offices and they're like established family offices. Established family offices are like, holy cow, we're over indexed into venture. Like, well, we put what we expected into it, but there are a couple of reasons why we won't be allocating in the near future. One, our public markets have tanked. What that means is that before we wanted private portfolio to be like 20% of our portfolio and then 80% public, but now it's looking like 70 and 30, or it's looking like 60 and 40. And because of that, the dollars we had initially intended for it to be for private markets in the next 2-3 years, we're putting into public market things, hedge funds, real estate, whatever, that kind of stuff, safe stuff. Then there's the emerging family offices. They have very little exposure to venture, or they directly invested into startups during the pandemic. And they realize, like angel investors, they've been burned as well. We invested in a $10 million round, 100 post on a no product kind of company. And they're like, we probably shouldn't have done that. We need to have a little bit more discipline. And so for these emerging family offices, they are investing in other funds to learn, and they are asking a lot of questions on a monthly, if not weekly basis. And a lot of fund managers have started realizing, hey, you know what, like, is my job being a fund manager or is my job being a professor? And I think it's both, but it's also, if you're willing to be that professor for your emerging LPs, you will do something that they cannot have access to in established funds, because the most at established funds you can get is probably like your annual general meetings, which are always great at these larger funds, as well as these quarterly reports. But other than that, you don't get individual attention or questions. And so they got really interested in the world of it, investing into emerging managers as well. And then you have the institutions, the endowments, the pension funds. Pension funds, very little exposure to venture. They want to do a lot more, but their average check size is $50 to $100 million. And they're like, how do I think about underwriting risk before I get TVPI, DPI, and IRR? I know I'm throwing a bunch of acronyms right now, but
we'll double click into them afterwards.
Sorry, long preamble. The current market, a lot of North American based LPs are over indexed into venture, and they're spending more time figuring out, one, do we want to re-up into existing managers? Meaning there are...
These are the established LPs.
Established, well, LPs that have allocated anything into venture, right? At least, I would say at least 5 to 10 funds. Okay. If they invest into that, they're like, okay, we need to start figuring out, do we want to reinvest into this fund manager's next fund, fund two, fund three, fund four, fund five, whatever it is, right? Some of them say no, because our strategy wants us to get more shots on goal, right? And we don't want any fund that has a reserve strategy, or we don't invest in any fund that's north of $100 million. And by the time a fund manager grows into a fund three, fund four, they're likely going over that $100 million threshold. And so like, we're probably not going to re-up. But that also opens up opportunities to invest in three new managers this year, right? Or next year. So Q1 of 2024 is a lot of discussions around, should we re-up? Should we invest in new, right? Or have the fund managers been accountable to the promises in which they gave us? One of the promises that a lot of fund managers gave during the pandemic was, we will invest your money over the next 2.5 to 3 years. You and I know that that hasn't been the case for a lot of funds. And I want to say the average fund deployment in like 2021 was like 1.5 years, if not south of that. It was insane, right? I knew a fund that deployed all their money in their $25 million fund in 9 months.
Holder, I think I've heard a story or a data point around one of the big hedge funds. I don't know if it was Tiger or whom exactly, that deployed like billions of dollars in like 6 months.
Yes, it was effectively that. And for those who don't know why that is a bad thing, one, the promise in which the strategy in which you pitch your LPs is, I'm going to deploy it over X amount of time. And the main thing there is you want to get time diversity. It's the same thing as when you're investing in the stock market for the first time. Most rookie kind of advice out there goes, you should dollar cost average, right? If you want to invest in Google, don't invest in Google all in like Q1 or like, you know, January 2024. Invest it like, you know, like first day of every single month over 9 months or whatever it is. If you want to put like $5K and spread it over 5 months, right? So that's usually the reason why, because there are vintages in the world of venture, right? There are specific vintages that are more interesting. You hear a lot of talk on Twitter and other social media these days, like 2023 and 2024 are going to be the best vintages, partly because one, valuations have come down. Two, I think founders are not as protective over their ownership as they used to be, at least in the past 2-3 years or so. But if you were investing in the 2020 and 2021, 2021 vintages, you're like thinking like, okay, well, a lot of the preference stack is higher than the valuation itself. So can the company actually rise into its next valuation? It's really, really hard to do so. And I have a huge headcount as well. So there's a lot of that. Q1 next year, discussing. Right now, a lot of folks are interested in emerging managers. So a lot of emerging manager programs being spun out. A lot of large like VC funds have also spun out their 50 mil proof of concept fund to funds and all that, 50 to 100 mil. And so you have a lot of that across the board as well. It's very interesting. For VCs, it is deal flow upstream of them. For LPs, it is to understand, can I find an asset that appreciates at least 25% year over year? And is it better to invest in my own managers or elsewhere?
What you describe right now is the landscape of LPs from the perspective of most established LPs. Now let's get back to the case of emerging LPs. And I would like to start by just characterize, is there any 2-3 categories of these emerging LPs? It's usually high net worth individuals, I guess family, small family offices. What are the most type of common profile of people or investors that are the one to get into this game?
There's a lot of segmentation in the world of LPs, right? There are LPs with mandates like fund to funds, like funds specifically allocated to venture funds as an asset class, right?
That wouldn't count as an emerging LP. That's more professional.
It's a professional LP, but for the most part, they're also learning. But they're trying to underwrite something where it's like, so if you're raising a fund to funds, we call it a double fee structure, right? You're probably taking a 1% management fee and anywhere between 5 to 10% carry on top of the asset in which you're investing, which is like usually 2 and 20, right? And so altogether that accounts for like 3% management fees, 30% carry. And if you're really going to take that much, you have to justify to your LPs why it is a good idea to do so. And there are very few justifications of why your LPs would be willing to give up 3 and 30 if they can have access to themselves. So in terms of category, there's high net worth individuals, and I would segment smaller family offices and larger family offices into two different segments. High net worth individuals, these are largely operators, angel investors, executives, people with, you know, north of $1 million net worth, probably have enough to invest probably like 100K, 250K check, give or take, right? These are folks who are largely familiar with either the tech in which startups are building upon, or they're familiar with the startup world altogether, or they've been involved in the venture space in one way or another. And so because of all that, they are knowledgeable about the asset, but they're probably either one, looking for deal flow, two, looking for learning, and three, looking to say like, hey, it's a social capital, so to speak, right? It's like, hey, I invested in the Sequoia of 2030 or like kind of thing, right? Like whatever it is, or the benchmark of 2040.
It's a very expensive toy.
One of the things I actually love in the Emerging LP blog post, he's the person who said it, Gautam Shawuk Ramani, who's at Anuka Capital. I used to work with him at OnDeck, but he's now raising his own fund to invest in Indian founders. He's LP'd into a couple funds.
He's the guy that said it's the most expensive newsletter subscription I've ever.
Yes, and I love that because it's so true, right? You're getting these hopefully quarterly, but if better, like monthly newsletters that are teaching you more than you could probably learn in a, nothing wrong with Stanford or anything or Harvard, but like better than a Stanford GSB class, specifically tailored towards startup asset class. So it's great. That's one. Smaller family offices largely fall into the same bucket. They invest probably anywhere between $250K to $1 million worth of checks. And they're also learning, and they're going to be likely on your speed dial, not because they have something to help, although they have a lot of them do, but they're probably going to be asking a lot of questions of like, oh, I'm trying to look into this new manager. It seems like you co-invested with them, doing a lot of reference checks, but also trying to understand the market altogether. What are you seeing in the crypto landscape? What are you seeing in the AI landscape? All that kind of stuff. Then you have fund of funds that I mentioned. They have a mandate to invest. They usually are fund size around $50 to $100 million. There are some that are south of that, some that are north of that. Then you have endowments. These are large institutions who write very large checks.
Would you also count those as emerging LPs?
There are some endowments that have very little exposure to venture, like Yale, Stanford, Bowdoin, a couple others have a jurisdiction. Like they've started investing in venture for the past like 2 decades or so.
They're the pioneers. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not emerging LPs at all. But there are institutions like,
and probably smaller universities as well.
Arizona State or something like that, right? There are like, maybe Arizona State's a bad example, but like, you know, there are a couple that have very little exposure, if not any exposure to venture, and they want to double down a lot more. And so they're learning, and so they're trying to get access. That's one. Then there are pension funds and sovereign wealth funds that also have very little exposure because they've traditionally invested into more predictable asset classes, but they write 50 to 100 mil checks. And then finally, there are RIAs, so registered investment advisors, right? Wealth managers that are trying to offer up a new asset class to their clients. It's like, you know, if you're really wealthy and you go to like Morgan Stanley or like, you know, Charles Schwab or something, they want to be like, hey, you know what? You want an aggressive portfolio. I want to be the one who offers you venture capital as an asset class. So you can take these, you can allocate 5 to 10% of your portfolio into it. For them, they're trying to learn so then they can educate their clients on what venture capital is and how it is a more promising option for them if they want to take an aggressive approach.
Would you say there's been an acceleration of interest from these emerging LPs in the last year or so? Or in your experience, it's mostly that this blog post has just shed light on a segment of people that you were not aware of? Because I'm also asking it from like the book Crossing the Chasm, like in which area of the curve are we in terms of VC as an investment product adoption?
It's a great question. The Emerging LP blog post opened my own aperture into the LP landscape. That is not to say it has been timed with how the general market is saying, right? There's this thing called availability bias where like, you know, you only see what's available to you and then you're like, oh, that seems to be a large proportion. I will say the shift for the LP landscape seemed to have stemmed around like the 2015 to 2017 era where a lot of folks started looking into it, but they were very silent on how they looked into it. Then you had the proliferation of a lot of fund managers going out there. It was very exciting not only to raise a $10, $25, $50 million fund, but also to thank the LPs in who backed you, right? And the LPs are also really happy to retweet because a lot of them are operator angels or, you know, like smaller family offices who want to build their brand as well. And so there ended up being this proliferation of folks on social media who are like, I have been involved in this. I've been an LP. A lot of them are still reticent. Like you started seeing, if you could just track like LinkedIn.
LPs flexing as well.
Yes, as LP flexing, right? And it's just like, I'm an LP in this fund. I'm an LP in that fund. And so you saw a lot more during, I would say, a 2021 era and after, right? And because of that, and very similar, like, you know, the more things you see on social media or television or whatever it is, you start thinking they exist more. And if if it's okay for your friends to boast that they're an LP, then maybe it's okay for you to talk about the fact that you're an LP as well. I also love what Beezer has done with OpenLP, right? Beezer Clarkson at Sapphire Ventures and her team there. With OpenLP, she has made being an LP and how to be an LP a much more upfront conversation. And so there's that. There's also podcasts like Origins, run by Nick at Notation, as well as Capital Allocators by Ted Seides. Invest Like the Best with Patrick O'Shaughnessy has talked about some LPs on there. Also, like, you know, Eric Tornberg and David Weisbird.
They just launched the LP podcast.
They launched the LP podcast as well. And so all this has gotten people to talk about it a lot more.
But that's very recent, right?
It's very recent.
Yeah.
At least in terms of the conversations. Before, it was all behind closed doors and all that.
You talked about access a few minutes ago. I mean, at least I remember my experience meeting LPs for the first time back when I was in Peru. I remember I met this very wealthy, well-known family in Peru because they used to be one of the owners of one of the largest banks in the country. And I remember that they hadn't invested in any VC fund in Latin America, but they had invested in Sequoia. So that always sort of stick to this idea sticking to my mind that if I'm an LP, I just want to invest in the most respected name, right? The Sequoias, the Benchmarks of the world. But it's not that easy. So why does it become so hard to access these funds as a new LP, as an emerging LP, meaning these funds are like the most respected, well-known funds?
Well, one, because of their fund size and because of SEC laws, you can only take 99 accredited investors and I think 2,000 qualified purchasers. Once again, not legal advice. Go talk to your, you know, investment advisor and all that. But those are usually the benchmarks, right? And what that means is that if you're raising a $1 billion fund and you can, let's round it to like 100 like accredited investor LPs, give or take, right? You have to take massive checks. Like you have to minimum checks is $10 million, right?
And if you're starting out, it sounds like a lot of money, right?
Right. And if you're only, like, if you're starting out, you're, like, at best, you're probably allocating 10 mil into the whole asset class altogether. And are you going to put it all into one? It's like putting all your eggs in one basket. And plus, you don't even know that much, minus the nickname and all that, right? And there's also this thing about persistency of results, right? They're, like, don't get me wrong, Sequoia, Benchmark, Greylog, they're incredible institutions, incredible firms. But not every fund is great in their, like assets of funds, right? There are some, every great fund has at least one or two that are just like not so great, that are south of 2x or whatever it is, right? So one, the access thing is their minimum check size they need.
And this connects to time diversification, which we were talking about.
Yes. And also if you want to put it, you're putting it into like the next 2, 3, maybe 5 years or so. You're not putting it all in one go. Yeah. So there's that. The second part is it's relationships, right? It's not about who you know. Like realistically, let's say you're an LP and you're like, if you wanted to, and you wrote like a 50 mil check, you could probably call up like Mark Andreessen. You can probably call up Doug Leone and be like, yo, I have this check. I would love to invest. There's a long wait list of individuals who would love to invest in these institutions, right? And so it's not about who you know, it's about how well you know them and how much they're willing to allocate for you, right? Like the first fund manager I invested, actually, I would say because of my check size, every fund manager I've ever invested into has wanted me on the metaphoric cap table for some reason outside of just capital. Because capital alone is not what I can necessarily provide the most. I can provide network, I can provide like thoughts and all that kind of stuff, right? And portfolio support. Two, a lot of people who want to invest in venture just don't have things that would help the fund in any meaningful way outside of capital. That could be in the form of portfolio connections, support, that could be like introductions to other LPs and all that kind of stuff. They don't have that, right? The third of which is really not that you can't get access to it. And sometimes you can get access if you write large enough of a check size. But more so, going back to it, you're like a lot of emerging LPs, they're trying to learn. Sequoia is not in the education business. As great as a firm they are, right? They're not in the education business. They're not going to sit down with you weekly to talk for you to talk to Doug, who's a very busy individual, or Roloff, who's a really busy individual already.
They'll send you their blog URL, basically.
Right. They'll send you their blog if they haven't written about it because it shouldn't be public knowledge or for whatever. So if you want a really tailored question.
Yeah.
They just don't have the time or the resource to allocate for that. That may change in the future as people build up their investor relations team, but for now, no, you're not going to get that white glove approach. And so your best bet, and a lot of data tends to lean towards this way, is probably to invest in emerging fund managers, fund ones through fund threes, where you can access it. But understandably, because there's so much risk there, you have to learn how to underwrite your own risk. And having these conversations are really important as well.
I always remember I flew to Barcelona, I think it was already 2 years ago, and I met this manager of a fund of funds. He was investing in a company with us. He has like a multiple hundreds of millions of dollars fund made up of family offices from Barcelona that want to invest in Silicon Valley funds. And he told us basically like a half an hour story of how he hustled his way into Rivet. He had to like call multiple persons to get to Mickey Malka, who's the founder and GP of Rivet. And he was like, for me, it was crazy. He's like, I had no idea it was so hard to invest in these funds. Literally, he almost was basically telling like he was thankful that they let him put his money in the fund. Like it was a favor that they did to him. I was like, that was just so crazy. And I literally had no visibility into how much access matter into VC funds. Because if you take it from the perspective of a startup, it's definitely not a, like even for a hot startup, I don't think it's that hard to get as it seems to be for a VC fund.
And there's some, like the best funds are often, well, not always, but there are a lot of funds that are like good funds that are very disciplined in nature. If they're trying to invest $3 to $5 million checks, leading rounds at the seed stage or whatnot, right? And they have a no reserve strategy because they don't believe that they can help their startup pass the Series A, they're going to have a very disciplined approach. They're probably going to raise $100-$200 million fund, and they're not going to go north of that. And even if you're like an LP who's like, I have a 50 mil check, would love to invest in you because you have some of the best vintages and all that kind of stuff, right? They're just being like, I can't take that check because in order to raise even more money, I would have to depart from the original strategy in which I have. I have to have a reserve strategy. I have to have all these other things now. And a lot of LPs don't want to be more than 10% of the fund, right? And so if you were putting a 50 mil check into a 100 mil fund, you are now a third of the whole fund. And that's way too much exposure of risk to you as an LP, but also to the fund manager. That ends up becoming like they're working for you in many ways. And a lot of GPs don't want to do that.
Yeah. And your fund size is your shorty. So you don't necessarily, very famously, Benchmark has always raised, I think, $400 to $500 million funds. And they have never, at least that I know, changed that even during 2021, where they could have raised multiple billions of dollars of funds if they wanted. Well, like other VC firms did, but they obviously stick to their game. You mentioned a bit a few minutes ago these concepts of metrics like TVPI, DPI, which are usually the metrics in which you use to evaluate a VC versus an or. Let's say a VC that has already track record, they're probably in their third, fourth fund. It's like sales and users for the startup, right? You need a few years of traction for those metrics to mean something. At the earliest stages in the first few months, whatever you, even if you have users or sales, that might not necessarily mean a lot because it's so early in the lifetime of the product to actually put a lot of meaning into those numbers. In the emerging playbook, you use that similar analogy same framework for VC funds. Mm-hmm. I really like how you weave the concept of pre and post pro market fit for VC funds. So would you mind elaborating that for the audience?
So I will preface with saying, and this is like independently said by both the data that informs Cambridge Associates, as well as Samir Kaji, who used to be the managing director at First Republic, as well as Silicon Valley Bank, and now running his own institution, Allocate, which is it takes about 6 to 7 years before a fund falls into a quartile. And so what that means is that all your metrics, I love it. Like, I
explain what's a quartile.
So like there's the top quartile, top 25%, second quartile, which is
in
like
terms of returns.
In terms of returns, okay, right? Fine. And so usually top quartile is like they're growing 25% year over year. So IRR, 25% in internal rate of return. Usually, it's hard to say usually because vintages are so different. But what we're probably looking at, you've returned some amount of DPI distributions within year 5 to year 7 kind of thing. Usually a 1x seems to be a good number. I can't say if that's like
DPI.
DPI. By year 5, year 7 kind of thing, right? And that probably makes your TVPI, your total value to paid in capital, to about like, I don't know, 4 or 5x or so within that time frame.
Meaning you have return 1x your fund, but you still have a portfolio that could potentially allow you to return, I don't know, 3 or 4 times extra.
Yes.
In terms of the cash that you have already returned to your
LP. Exactly. I mean, like when you invest into a startup, let's say at the seed round and then like by the Series A, it raises like on a 4x step up, right? 4x markup. that's not realized return. You can't just like...
That's book value. Hmm?
That's the book value. So total value to paid-in capital, TVPI, is effectively an account of book value plus like the actual cash. And I love what Chris Duvos calls it, but he calls it moolah in the coolah. And I think I wrote about it several times at this point. But that's usually what top quartile. And then there's like second quartile, like top 25, like 25% to like 50% kind of thing. And then, you know, the rest of the quartiles. It's so hard to tell in the early years because, I mean, I kid you not. Like, so I'm an active LP now. And so I kind of look at a lot of pitch decks these days.
How many funds have you invested?
I have invested in 4 funds to date. And this is like, I started last year. Yeah. So I've probably been...
You're an emerging LP yourself.
I'm an emerging LP. I like to ask questions. I like to learn a lot. And so, yes, the thing about, I kind of like, you know, like I see all these pitches and some fund ones came up in like 2020 and 2021. And I love it in the sense it's hilarious because they would come to me and they're like, guess what? My fund one IRR is 110%. What? Like, and I was like, do you think this is sustainable? Like, you know, 110%, that's amazing. Because if you're 110%, everybody should be investing in your fund. That's better than any other asset altogether, right? Consistently, right?
Crypto.
Well, crypto, it's hard to predict consistently, right? But it's like...
But at that point in time, in 2021, right?
At that point in 2021, it's like, yes, like, you're like, 110%, that's amazing. And it was like, oh yeah, it's like, I bet, even for fund two, the lowest IRR I can get is 70 or 80%. I'm like, where are you coming up with these expectations? And the numbers look great. Like, you know, I think the TVPI for at least the fund in which I'm talking about, I think they were sitting at like an 8X after like 2 years. No DPI, obviously, no DPI yet. Too early for DPI. And there are like tons of folks who are just like, I would say any IRR I see that's north of 50%, I have question marks around.
Okay.
It's because the immediate follow-up question is like, do you think that's sustainable? Like, why are you pitching this, right? And I love fund managers that come to pitch me and they're like, hey, I know my fund one currently it's at net TVPI 50%+, but I do think there are certain assets in my portfolio or certain startups in my portfolio that is raised on too high of a valuation. I've taken a preemptive haircut. I've taken a 50% cut off their valuation just because I don't think they're worth that much. And they're probably going to raise a down round in the near future. And my TVPI, if I were to account for that, is actually like 27%, 28%. And I'm like, okay, I enjoy that measured approach a lot more than someone boasting they have the most amazing TVPI IRR and all that kind of stuff. Back to your question. Pre-product market fit, post-product market fit fund. I believe the initial framework of thinking first came from Samir Kaji, who is brilliant. I highly recommend people to look at his work. But fund one, you're selling a promise. Fund two, you're selling a strategy. Fund three, you're selling the returns on fund one. Sometimes fund three, it's fund four, then you're selling the returns on fund one, right? And that means in fund three, you're still selling a strategy. What that means is that fund one, you are like a founder with an idea. It's like a pre-seed round. Like you might have a product, you have no customers, or maybe very little customers, not enough to say like people love what you're building, right? Outside of your friends and family. And you're saying, hey, I have this angel track record, a syndicate lead track record, or maybe like I was a partner previously at this fund and this is what my track record looks like, right? But you're going into a completely new direction and it's this faith that an LP needs to have on you and your dream, right? And it's how accountable are you to the promises in which you give? Are you realistic in your expectations, right? If you're pitching 110% IRR, oh, hell no, man. Like your promise is somewhere up there. It's in Disneyland, right? It's not on Earth. And then fund two, you're selling a strategy. What that means is that, hey, you realize 2 to 3 years later after starting fund one that you realize what worked and what didn't work in fund one. And your fund two is an iteration, or fund three as well, is an iteration of what worked and what didn't work. You're going to double down on that, right? Because you are a strong believer that if you doubled down on what worked and avoided things that what didn't work, you will probably improve your IRRs by 5, 10, whatever percent, right? And then fund three, like returns have settled in, DPI has settled in, you've settled into your quartile, you can start saying, hey, I'm really good at TVPI and DPI and IRR kind of thing, right? In a fund one, fund two, fund three, I can't speak for every LP. There's a saying in the world of LPs, like if you know one LP, you only know one LP, right? So I can't speak for the industry and I shouldn't speak for the industry. If anyone gets like, this is how all LPs think, they're completely full of BS, right? I will share how I think, but it's largely informed by a lot of conversations in which I have, which is one, for pre-product market fit funds, right? Fund one, fund two, fund three is very similar to pre-seed founders. You're not looking at traction. There is no traction to look at, right? What you're looking at is...
Could we say the fund three is like the Series A or not yet?
Fund three could be the Series A. To be fair,
you start seeing metrics.
Yes, fund three could be the Series A. And I'm hesitant there because fund four, for sure, you're like, proper growth stage fund series B and onwards.
Usually where also where you see like a big drop off in the conversion rate from,
yes,
from let's say fund three and fund four, which similar when a seed company going to series A, that's like the biggest. Yes. After series A and series B, that then it's usually a higher graduation rate.
Right? Like from seed to series A, or like series A, like that series A stage effectively, for the founder, their job description changes the most. Yeah. And either you evolve to fit that job description or you're unable to fit that job description, right? And I think very similarly, like you, like in a fund one, you are selling like, you know, here's the promise, right? Fund two, you're selling like a seed stage. You have a product, you have some traction. By fund three, you're series A, give or take. And you're like, I have a product. I have traction. I might upsell you to another product now or something like that. You might have a growth fund or whatever these other things, right? That stem from that. Or you might hire a team and all that, right? You might hire another partner, right? And every new partner like starts managing $25 to $40 million of their, like out of the fund, right? So because of all that, what do I measure? In a founder, you'd probably measure their rate of iteration. Like how fast do they iterate? Do they make mistakes fast enough? And are they learning fast enough where they're iterating on the product? Are they engaging with their customers, right? A lot of fund one, fund two, you're doing a lot of reference checks. Who are the founders you know? Who are the co-investors you've worked with? I remember talking to a space tech fund, $10 million space tech pre-seed seed fund. And they're like, oh yeah, we were early investors in SpaceX. I'm like, oh my God, that's great. That's great. Like, how did you recognize it? And then you look into the references and you're like, they were in the series D of a syndicate of SpaceX. And then you're like, I don't think that counts, especially if you're a pre-seed seed fund that's off thesis, right? Like you just series D does not count. And series D, I don't even call it early stage anymore, right? Series A, you can
even more if you see that SpaceX, you wouldn't be raising a $10 million fund.
Yeah, you would not
you
be
raising a hundreds of million dollars.
Exactly. And so like, there's no, so we do a lot of references. We talk to folks, are the things that in which you are saying, does it match up with what actually happened, right? So we talk to founders, we talk to co-investors, we talk to former colleagues, other things we do. Something I like doing it, and I learned this from Eric Bond at Hustle Fund, which is how accountable are they to their own communication channels? If they say, we're going to send you monthly investor updates on the first of every single month, they better freaking send it. If they delay by 3, 4, 5, whatever days a week, there are things that will slip, right? And that, and if they're going to slip now, so early in their fund journey process, they're likely going to skip much later, right? And I love reading investor updates before the fund comes together because there's probably weekly, monthly or so updates that you get from founders, and you have a really good peek into how the GP thinks. And so I love that. The communication, how accountable to, if they say, we're going to send, like, we would love to send monthly, I'd much rather have a GP who's like, I'd love to send monthly updates to you, but realistically, and just make it sustainable for the next 10, 15 years, I'm going to send you quarterly updates. I'd much rather them say that and they stick to it, right? That's one. I mean, that's two. The third of which is, I think I've written about this before, but maybe it sits in my draft somewhere in my blog, but is I like to think a lot about selfless and selfish motivation. And what that means is, so selfless motivation, that's the one you go to PR and TechCrunch and Forbes and you're like, hey, this is how awesome I am. This is what motivates you because you've changed the world in some fundamental way. You're backing underrepresented founders, whatever it is, right? That's the thing that, like, you know, you get up in the morning, you're like, I'm excited to do this. Just like being an early stage founder, days and weeks and months are going to suck because things don't go your way. And so what's much more important for me, and it's the same thing I do when I invest in founders, right, is what is your selfish motivation? And I want you to be as selfish as possible, right? Because I want to know that on your worst day, it's not the dream of you changing the world that's going to keep you going. It's like, it's the fact that you need to put dinner on the dinner table and that's got to keep you going. Or your ex-girlfriend says like, hey, you know what? I don't think you're ever going to make it, right? And you want to prove your ex wrong. Like you want your ex to read TechCrunch or Forbes or whatever one day and be like,
face.
And see your face and like, oh man, I should have stuck with that guy or like, you know, stuck with that girl, right? I want that because that is a very visceral response because on the worst days that'll keep you going. For me, that is a leading indicator of grit and passion, right? And then the last thing, well, not the last thing, but one other important thing I look for is, have they achieved something great in the past? Doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't have to be in the world of startups, right? Have they gotten to a C-suite position at a Fortune 500 company? Have they become an Olympian? Have they gone through military special forces? Have they started their own Michelin-starred restaurant? I don't care what it is, right? But it has to be something like great. Everyone can look at that and be like, okay, this person won a Nobel Prize and they know how hard it is to get that Nobel Prize or whatever that accolade is. That is a proxy for, if you actually know how to go through the struggle. Because there are so many folks in 2020 and 2021 who are like, you know what? I would love to add the word investor, LP, angel investor on my LinkedIn bio. It's a battle of the bios, right? But once shit hits the fan, they give up. And you have so many folks who just quietly retire. They're not raising their fund too. They like, in fact,
interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of this and a lot of like fund one managers, even though they like, let's say it was a fund one, 50 mil fund to invest in crypto, instead of returning the capital back to their LPs, which I think is a very smart thing to do and something that people used to do back in the 2000s, they're like, I've got to find a way to spend it. I'm like, no, you don't. If you can't spend it, if your strategy no longer works, I think LPs will respect you a lot more if you return that capital back to them.
You mentioned this idea from Eric Bann from Hustle Fund around how the VC communicates and they've been consistent with their communications. What I like about that idea is that it's a behavior that you can identify. That the challenge in VC is like, even as a VC yourself, is that it's very hard. Like you'll take a lot of time, like I don't know, 5-10 years to start seeing if you're actually good. So it's very hard to know what to do. I mean, in the day to day, in the week to week, because you have no idea until a long time passes by that if you're doing is working or not. So I wonder if there's other types of behaviors as this consistency of communication that you describe that are good predictors of investors eventually being able to return the capital.
There's something I do, not with everyone, but at least of those that call it into question, is I look at email response rates. Personally, I'm pretty fast with email. I want to say, unless I'm on vacation, then like I respond to emails like within 48 hours, which I think is still faster than most people. But normally I respond to emails within 24 hours. Because I do that, and if it is true that I am the hot guy on the block because I'm an LP kind of thing, right? I expect GPs to respond within a similar time frame. If there are GPs that are like, oh my God, David, I love you. I would love to have you as an LP. And then I was like, okay, that's cool. Do you mind sharing with me your data room or your deck? Or can you answer this one question like after this conversation? And they take 2-3 weeks to get back to you. Nah, like, you know, if they're going to do that to me and I'm like the person they're courting, it's like going on a dating, I'm going on Hinge or like Tinder or whatnot. I'd be like, hey, you know, Enzo, you're like the hottest guy out there. And I'm so excited to meet you in person. And then you have that like date, the first date, and they take like 2-3 weeks to get back to you. You're like, oh, I guess they're not interested anymore, right? Response rates email response rates are really important to me, at least. Because if they take that long to respond to me, I imagine they may take longer
for
founders.
Yeah.
And if you want to help founders and venture capital, I had this debate with my friend. Is venture an asset class or a service industry kind of thing?
It's both.
And like you teeter depending on what role you are in a VC and depending on what your fund strategy is. But for the most part, it's both services for a lot part, right? And so in the services business, right, like your favorite brands are probably like when the customer success gets back to you so fast and you're like, oh my God, like, you know, Amazon got back to me, like, you know, they gave me a full refund for the thing. I expect GPs to do that with their founders. Why? Not only because it increases NPS and all that, because that will help them win deals. Because there are three jobs of an investor, right? Sourcing, picking, winning. You need to be good at least in two of them, in at least two of them, right? And so that is a proxy for you winning deals. And you can probably go into the archives to find this, but Twitter, now called X, I guess. There's this Twitter thread that I believe Pat Grady, who's a partner at Sequoia, wrote on his like 10th anniversary for being at Sequoia or whatnot, right? And he's like, here are the 10 lessons I learned while I was at Sequoia. And one of those lessons in which he shared was, so his partner of his life, romantic partner, is Sarah Guo, formerly of Greylock, right?
Yeah, now she also has a fund.
Now she has her own fund, AI, I think.
Yep.
There was a deal that both Sequoia and Greylock were fighting over. They're like, we really want to invest in the founder. And Sequoia lost to Greylock. They were competing for that deal.
He and his partner.
One of the things was that they usually keep work and personal life pretty separate. So they don't talk about work as much because they're competing firms, right? And they're investing in competing industries as well. And so anyways, it turns out like Sarah was a partner for that deal for Greylock and Pat was a partner for that. And she won. And the reason she won is because she would like go hustle to find the founder. And she'd be like, hey, you know, like if the founder needs something at 2 a.m., she'd be there to deliver that, like get that to the founder and all that, right? There are a few investors that I know who actually go out to the founder's respective geography and goes to court them and find them instead of having that founder come to Silicon Valley or wherever it is, right? I think that's fascinating because you need to do that to win deals. And response rate is the simplest, lowest hanging fruit of what you can do to win deals. And if a GP can't do that to an LP, I call that into question. In diligence, there are times where I just ask the GP to pull up their inbox, their email inbox on a Zoom call or whatnot. Like, I don't do this with everyone, but there are some people that call that question, like that call that into question, right? And I'm like, you say you're a fast responder. You say you're inbox zero kind of person. I kind of want to actually see it, right? And some GPs aren't that way. They say it, but they aren't that way. And they're like, oh, it's just because today, this week's a busy week. This is because I'm in a fund. If they have an excuse for it, they're like, okay, fine. That's not a true value or rule for you.
How common is it in your experience that VCs, I mean, GPs pivot their areas of focus or their markets of focus that they initially had pitched to LPs? Because, I mean, for startups, that's table stakes.
Yeah.
I wonder how true is that for GPs.
Yeah, I remember actually speaking of which.
Especially emerging LPs who, I mean, just started thinking about their thesis ideas probably a few months ago, a year ago at most.
Yeah. There's so many things I want to talk about here. So I'll start with that, at least for startups, it's table stakes. You're supposed to pivot all the time. And I think Mike Maples at Floodgate once said, like, I think 80 or maybe I think it's 90% of their exit profits have come from pivots. So it's just like, you're going to pivot, right?
It's expected.
It's expected. For a fund, should you be pivoting? Once again, every LP has their own thoughts on this. There are some LPs like, no, they should never pivot. They've pitched me a 10-year strategy or a 15-year strategy, and they should stick to it. If they didn't have conviction behind this, they should have never pitched this to me, right? And there are other folks like, dude, like, how do you predict what's going to happen in 10, 15 years? Who knew that ChatGPT was going to have the wave it has now 10 years ago, right? There's different ways of thinking. It's funny that you ask this question now. I'm writing a blog post right now called Intuition versus Discipline. And I'm asking a lot of multi-cycle investors how they think about balancing intuition versus discipline. Discipline meaning a scorecard, thesis, all the kind of, how often is their thesis drift? And there's some investors like David Hornick who are very intuitive in nature. David Hornick is one of those folks that very good at sourcing, very good at picking. I guess he's also good at winning deals, but like those are his, like, I think, strengths when it comes to it, right? And so there's some people like that. There are other folks like Correlation Ventures, Signal Fire, a bunch of these other ones that are very like data-driven, thesis-driven. Yeah.
Weird rich are like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then they're like, they almost want to, like, there are certain venture firms out there, they want to take the human out of the mix as much as they can and let data inform that decision. And that is their whole fund effectively, right? So funds pivoting, in my opinion, is okay. If you were able to predict what happens 10, 15 years from now, you would be a phenomenal stock market investor. Like, you would make so much money, right? Like, you would be God. You would be like a freaking genie. So I think it's okay to pivot. That said, if you do want to pivot, I think there should be preemptive communication. You should not pivot, then tell your LPs. You should tell your LPs, I'm seeing the market grow in this way, where it's moving in that direction. And because of that, we want to bet 10, 20% of the strategy on that. Are you okay with it? And this is how we're communicating with it, right? And there's some GPs that do is like, hey, you know what? If we're pivoting and that's not the fund in which you invested in, and this is a luxury for established GPs, but like I know, I understand we're pivoting. If you do not want to fulfill the rest of your capital calls because we're pivoting, I completely understand. And I think that is building that authenticity and that humility of like, we weren't able to predict the market, but we want to go where the puck is going right now.
And it also transmits conviction.
Yes.
Right? I'm not willing to take your money if I have to do this orifice that I have already pivoted away from.
Yes. And usually for pivots, from what I've seen so far, are no more than 10, 20% of the fund. If you need to pivot more than 20% of your fund, you either should give that money back, raise a new fund on a new strategy, or I think you should limit your exposure because there's a lot of like shiny object mentality in venture, right? And I mean, we've seen that with crypto in hindsight. I think AI is happening now. I think AI is going to be a generational shift altogether. That said, there's so much noise out there, right? And I think a lot of...
It's both true that it's a generational shift, but at the same time that 99% of companies won't make.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of noise. There's like 99% of any kind of company, like any kind of subject matter will not make it.
I mean, getting back to this point you were referencing around not being thesis driven, I wanted to get your take on specialist funds versus generalist funds, because that's something one of your in the emerging LP playbook, that's something that was mentioned, and I quote that one of the red flags that LPs usually see on GPs is the lack of ability to zero in on a particular thesis, for example B2B SaaS with certain characteristics. But I wonder if it's a question of go to market from a GP perspective, in a sense that as an emerging VC or emerging manager, you must earn the right to be a generalist. So you have to start with a very specific thesis, let's say EdTech, B2B SaaS, whatever. Probably EdTech or B2B SaaS, it's still too general. It's today in the current market, and you have to have a much more narrow view. And then once you do well, then you earn the right to expand from that specific sector to a much more broader view.
So yes, first of all, yeah, you're right. Winners write history, right? Like, you know, if like you can say whatever you want. Like many of the successful funds today are like generalist in nature. We're still too early to see if there are any. Well, actually, there are a couple like specialist investors out there, like, you know, Saster, Craft Ventures, Forerunner Ventures, who are very specialist in nature, and they've done very well for themselves, right? But there are a lot of other funds who are just like generalist in perspective. So on the specialist versus generalist kind of thing, I want to caveat first with specialist. Most people define it as industry specialty, right? It's like you're only crypto or you're only AI or B2B SaaS or whatever, deep tech or whatever it is, right? Yes, that's one aspect of specialization. There's another aspect of specialization, which I call like functional expertise, which is like maybe you're like the best engineer. You're just like, you're just really good at building products, or you're really good at exec coaching and all that. So for example, I'll give two examples. One, this one's an established GP. I think they've done it for the past like 8 or 9 years or so. So they've been in the industry long enough. But before he started his fund, he used to go to his portfolio company's offices and spend 1 day per week coding alongside with them and debugging their product with them, right? And it's just like hilariously just like close to like the founders, because then he knew everything that the founders are building. He knew how to like build it, and he was just like an engineering whiz as well, right? He could also like build things much faster than the average engineer out there. And so that's like, and now I think they've grown so much and they've gone a little bit more generalist in thesis, but his specialization for the most part was like, I know how to help founders build products, and if something's not working on the engineering front, I can actually go in and be helpful to them. That's one. Another one on the specialization side of things is, this is an emerging GP right now. I love her to death. She's great. Phenomenal. But when she first pitched me her fund, she was like, do you know who the only person in the entire company who never gets a performance review? Do you know who that person is? And that person's the CEO. Everyone else gets a performance review, right? From the C-suite down, everyone gets that every six months, every year. They'll be like, hey, you know what? Here's how you improve. Here's how you get your bonuses. Here's how you like grow into your next job description. Here's how you get all that. But the CEO is the one person who doesn't. And if we look at the data, founder-led companies often perform much better, exit for a higher amount. And so, because like, for many qualitative reasons as well, like they believe in the product a lot more rather than a professional CEO coming in and all that. And she's like, I want to help more founders lead their companies till the IPO. And I will be the person who helps, and given her a role as former exec and all that, I will help that founder grow and like involve in their job description at every fundraising point. And that's why I'm really useful there. Other than that, she's a generalist thesis, invests across the board, but specializes in a very particular function that is very useful for a founder, going back to winning deals. So those are examples of specialization, but not in the industry sense of specialization. I think there are many ways to make money at the end of the day. You can be a generalist and do very well, generalist in quotes, like do very well. You can be a specialist and do very well. At the point when you become a generalist, you end up building a platform, right? Like the Andreessen Sequoias, they have such a large team at this point. You have a now whole platform helping you instead of like Benchmark, who's an individual partner that's helping you, right? So many ways to win, many ways to slice the cheese effectively. And it is the biggest thing that you have to convince LPs on is, what is the GP thesis fit? Like whatever strategy you're going for, why is that a great fit for the background in which you come from?
Super interesting. And I like this differentiation in being a specialist on a sector versus a specific expertise. And I probably, your answer went a bit side of where I was trying to go. I wanted to go more into the sector side of things, because, and this ties to one of the previous questions we were discussing, is the sector ties to your TAM. As a VC, you also have a TAM. If you are in, let's say, B2C social, I mean, you have a particular TAM. If you are in B2B SaaS, you have a particular TAM. And as you raise a subsequent fund, most GPs increase the size of their fund. And depending on which sector you are, how specialized that sector is, you may get to a point in which the TAM is not enough to justify the fund you want to raise.
Yes. So to reel us back into the sector-specific specializations, Mike Maples once said, your fund size is your strategy. If I could add on to that, or if any other LP can add on to that, your market is also determinant of your strategy as well, right? So there's an LP out there. She once told me, which I think is really fascinating because they built such an amazing data warehouse is that for general industries, there's a 2% outlier rate, which means like, hey, like 2% unicorn, right? Out of every 100 companies, you're likely to get two companies that have become unicorns, right? The outlier rate, obviously, if you want to take traditional statistics, is 1.5 times interquartile range, right? And for general industries, that means it's like north of $1 billion. Like $1 billion or more is like, that's exit value of that respective industry. There are other industries, and this is more of an example, but there's industries like health tech, bio, that are different because their exits are not IPOs. Most bio health tech companies don't go IPO.
Acquisitions.
Right? They go through acquisitions. And their outlier rate is actually between $500 million to $2 billion, right? That's your exit value. And so if you reel it back in, it's like, hey, you know what? Let's say you're a fund that takes 20% ownership on entry. That dilutes by 50% to like 10% because you've got pro rata for one or two rounds after. 10% of a 500 mil exit, it generally comes out to like 50 mil, right? And if you actually think about that, if that's the largest, like, you know, exit you can go, the outcome you can go for, you probably at max
can be a $50 million fund.
$50 million fund, because you're going to have a couple other companies and hopefully that gets you to a 2X, 3X fund at the very end, right? And so you're probably capped somewhere there if you're only focusing on health tech, which is why you have so many large funds, generalist funds, quote unquote, right? Who end up doing, oh, we do health tech and we do fintech and we do something else, right? And they'll only do a health tech thing. That said, things may change in the future, right? Like, you know, what got us here might not get us there. Like there might be larger IPOs for health tech companies. So to your point, does cap how big your fund size can be. If your fund is like, I'm only going to invest in founders who are former barbers and run salons, that's probably a smaller TAM than other industries we could be talking about.
That's fascinating. I became very close, good friends with a guy, Leo Arango, who will be on a pod soon, who's a partner at this firm called One Way Ventures, mm-hmm. that they invest only in immigrant founders. That was a very interesting thesis. And there's, he mentioned this data point that 50% of all unicorn founders are actually immigrants. He told me like they're very highly represented on the outliers, but very not really well represented in the top of funnel, basically. So that's basically their thesis, investing only in immigrant founders to the US.
There are a couple funds. I love that thesis, by the way. I'm trying to do my own data analysis on this, but there are a couple other fund managers building on that thesis as well.
So let's start wrapping up. I have just a few questions left. I want to take everything that we've talked about, LPs and the world of emerging LPs, and leave it in some practical lessons or tips for emerging managers, for people that are raising funds. So I think everything that we've discussed in mind begs the questions, should emerging managers, say PCs in their first to third fund, focus their fundraising on emerging LPs? Or how would you advise them in that front?
So you should always, for fund one and fund two, you're likely only going to get emerging LPs. You're not going to get established LPs for a couple of reasons. One, their check size is too big. Two, they love to build relationships over a long-term period of time, right? Like it's for them, they at least want to build a relationship across a couple funds, which probably means anywhere between 3 to 5 years, right? So there are a couple things. So fund one, especially if you have, and I'm speaking largely on the US side of things, and I know your audience is quite global in nature, but if you're under like a 10 mil fund, you can have 249 accredited investors. And if you have north of a $10 million fund, you can have 99 accredited investors, right? Which means your check sizes are probably hovering around tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and maybe in the low millions. You're not going to entertain many established LPs for the most part for that, right? Unless they have a dedicated fund-to-fund strategy for you. Most of the time, you will be spending with emerging LPs. That said, you should be talking to established LPs.
Okay.
When you should be talking to established LPs is not getting to your first close. They will just gonna waste your time to your first close, right? You should probably not even do it for a second close. But as you're getting to a final close, you should get them on the investor newsletter. Because once you've got the momentum and you're not like trying to build rapport with a bunch of folks, that's when you start building with them. Say, hey, you know what? This is someone we got to keep an eye out for. And make sure you have regular catch-ups with them. Often. And I think it's Harry Stebbings who said this. I think that he meets with like 1 to 2 LPs per week kind of thing. I think that's important. You should always do that. Running your own fund, you're a three-sided marketplace, right? There's the LPs, there's the founders, and there's also other VCs in the ecosystem. And you should be spending as much time as you can with all three of them because you're trying to build relationships with all three of them.
Now, there's this phrase for startups that actually read also on your blog. You have this I think one of the articles was called 99 Lessons That You Won't Find Anywhere in the Internet.
Yes.
It was titled something around that. And you mentioned this phrase, which is always very common for startups. Like, ask for money and you'll get advice. Ask for advice, you'll get money. I wonder how much does it applies to emerging managers in your experience?
There's no silver bullet. Like, I can't even, yes, I did put that on the, I think it was like called the...
Sorry to interrupt you, but let's put it more in a frame of how do you suggest emerging managers to build relationships with LPs?
So you kind of prefaced my answer, but like effectively, like there's no silver bullet. So yes, that is true in broad strokes, right? Like if you want money, you should ask for advice. What I mean by ask for advice, you'd be like, let's say Enzo, you're an LP, right? And I'd be like, Enzo, I heard so many great things about you. I specifically loved you being on a certain podcast, and this is the one tidbit I really liked. Because of that, because of your podcast appearances, I know you're really strong when it comes to portfolio construction. You've helped a lot of other GPs do portfolio construction. I'm currently going through that exercise right now. I'm raising a fund one and, you know, all cards on the table. I'm halfway closing the fund one. So I'm not exactly pitching you necessarily, but as I'm building out my portfolio of, you know, how much, what percent needs to be seed stage investment, what percent needs to be series A investments, how do I underwrite each before I double down on the pro rata? I would love your thoughts on it. And as you slowly share these more, and that's the first conversation. Second conversation, you follow up with that advice, like, hey, I learned so much. Here's how I've thought about it. I'm doubling down on what the advice you shared. And your kind of strategy, whether you want or not, becomes closer and closer aligned to the advice of what that LP shared with you. That said, not all LPs are right. Like there's a great book, by the way, called The Messy Middle by Scott Belsky. It's his yellow book. It's a great book on product. But there's a line in that book where Scott quotes Hunter Walk from a homebrew and now running Screen Door, which I'm paraphrasing here, which is if you sometimes listen to your investor's advice, you might fail. But if you always listen to your investor's advice, you're guaranteed to fail. And I love that because you as a GP need to have a head above two shoulders and decide not all advice you're going to get from LPs is good, is accurate. It might be good, but it might not be relevant to your situation. Right. And so you need to decide. And if you don't decide to go towards the strategy in which they would like to invest in, you need to let them know and the rationale of why you did so. I'll share another example. Jacqueline at Foundry Group, they're an LP. They have a fund to fund strategy. They invested into Hustle Fund's fund too. But Hustle Fund and both Eric and Jacqueline has told me on separate accounts about this. So, and it's public at this point, so I can share this. But Eric and Elizabeth pitched Hustle Fund fund one to Jacqueline and the team at Foundry. They said no. They're like, we don't believe in your strategy. We like concentrated portfolios and we think yours is too much spray and pray and all that. Spoiler alert, they ended up investing in fund two. And one of the greatest reasons why, at least this is like speculation from Eric's side of things, was we just wrote very consistent investor updates and we constantly updated them. And we just like, here's why we invest in this company. This is why we invest. We have high conviction on this. Despite having a large portfolio, we have high conviction on this company. And they kept doing that. I forget what the cadence of that was. I believe it's monthly. And at fund two, something along the lines of Jacqueline's like, hey, you know what? Like, we may not entirely agree with it, but you are by far one of the most communicative kind of fund managers we've ever chatted with. And although we don't have a strategy to invest in a fund like yours, we want to see how your strategy plays out and it may prove us wrong. And they invested in the fund too. Eric and Elizabeth didn't use the Foundry Group's advice of like stay concentrated and all that, but we're regularly communicative. Going back to advice on how to build relationships with LPs.
This example you just described makes me think of Mark Suster we invest in lines, not dots.
Yes, it's exactly that. Actually, speaking of Mark Suster, he has this line, which I think he borrows from someone else, but he says, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care, which goes to exactly to the LP world, right? LPs want to build relationships. So for a founder in which you're talking with, like you're investing in them, you're building this, I don't know, like 5-7 year relationship at most before they kind of go out of your orbit, your immediate orbit, right? For LPs, especially established LPs.
Maybe even longer.
It's longer. It's multi-vintage. And if they invest in three funds, it's already like 20, 25 years of a relationship, right? That's multi-decade. Because it's a marriage. Like Chris Duvos once told me, most LP relationships last longer than the average American marriage, right? And it's completely that, right? If you want to court that LP, if you want to court that boyfriend, girlfriend, whoever it is, right? You've got to show that you care. And you know a bunch of LPs. I know a bunch of LPs. Because of what I've written an emerging LP playbook and what I've write regularly on my blog, a lot of people ask me, say, oh, can you introduce me to this person? Can you introduce me to that person? And I'm sure you get so many intro requests as well. And at some point, like, let's take an example. Beezer at Sapphire, right? She recently came out with a north of $1 billion fund with CalSTRS to invest in like emerging managers and all that, right? She came out with that. People found that I wrote about Beezer, and Beezer has helped me in a couple blog posts as well. And that they're like, oh my God, David must know Beezer. I would love intros to Beezer. And I kid you not, when they launched their funds with CalSTRS, I had like 50 people who are like, dude, can you introduce me to Beezer? I'm like, no, I can't introduce all of you to Beezer, right? And at some point I had to like protect Beezer from this horde of individuals who want to like back channel and find a way to her, right? And so what I tell a lot of fund managers, it's, In being someone who does a lot of intros, usually to the same people, because intros always usually go to the same people, to be fair, right? Or around the same time. And it's so much easier for me to say yes to, oh, Enzo, you're hosting an event. It's much easier to get, Beezer, my friend's hosting an event. Would you be interested in showing up at this person's event? Because I know you happen to be in the Bay Area at this point in time, right? That's a much easier ask than me going, Beezer, I have this person who wants to borrow 30 minutes of your time to chat. And then think about her time. That's just from me. Think about all the other people that she knows that would like to get her time as well, right? So anyways, I think hosting events or building relationships in ways that's not just a coffee chat to pick your brain, to pitch you my fund, or to go through the normal application process would be best.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's finding a way around. Like, you would give the same advice to a founder.
Oh, did you say so it's a founder? Yeah.
For instance, something that I've learned to do is, because I know a lot of founders from outside the Bay Area that come to the Bay Area to raise money, and they usually come around conferences.
Yes.
And I've told them, like, don't come when there's conferences, because I feel like that's the worst moment, because everyone thinks, let's go to the Bay Area when there's a conference. So there's, you go, you get an investor in a conference or an event, whatever, and there's hundreds or thousands of people at the same moment, right?
I mean, even the fact, like, you know, let's say at TechCrunch Disrupt fairly recently, they had a dating...
speed dating events.
Dating cafe.
Even that, I think that is bad.
No, I think it's horrible. Like, I think the folks who are organizing at TechCrunch, they've put a lot of work into it. I respect...
I think there's great intentions behind that. But if you're talking to 10 founders in a round for 10 minutes each, you're not going to remember anything.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're a founder courting a VC, or if you're a VC courting an LP, if anything, you should be hosting your own events, because having your own name... Like, even if it's like everyone comes for TechCrunch, you know people are going to come in for TechCrunch and all that. And you go like, hey, I'm hosting like, you know, Enzo's happy hour, right? As your name is stamped on there, they're more likely to remember you for the long term. It's easier to get their mind space if you're hosting an event around that, but don't be another attendee. If you're another attendee, you're another number.
Totally agree with that. Just to wrap up this idea, what are the most common, biggest mistakes you see GPs committing in their fundraising process?
There's a lot. I'll pick a couple. One is probably logo shopping. I love this term. What does logo shopping mean? Having awesome downstream investors or co-investors, that's table stakes. Everyone has. In fact, if you don't have it, that's alarm bells, right?
Because it means your investments are pretty bad, basically.
Right, exactly, right? Because as an early stage investor, as a VC investor, your goal is to invest in the non-obvious before it becomes obvious. Because it should be obvious at some point, you should have big names on there, right? If you don't have it, whatever. The majority of GPs I chat with, they're like, oh my God, Andreessen's my follow-on investor. Sequoia's my follow-on investor. Greylock's my follow-on investor. I'm like, they're everyone's follow-on investor. Not only that, I know specifically like GPs at those funds specifically invest in emerging fund managers as their LPs so they can get deal flow. That's the whole purpose of that, right? So that's table stakes. There's no point in that.
So you mean logo shopping from the LP perspective?
No. Looking from the LP's perspective is fine, right? But then it comes down to like, okay, if like, I'm making this up. If Reid Hoffman's putting in a 5K LP check, I don't know, right? But if Reid Hoffman's putting in $1 million check or a 5, like, okay, I'll take that, right? But also logo shopping on the startup side of things, which is like, here's my portfolio, going back to the space tech fund, right? Like SpaceX was like a Series D syndicate investment. You don't count anymore. That should not be on a logo on your deck, right? And so be honest and forthcoming with it. The flip side is So going back to it, like fund ones, fund twos, the fact it's called a fund, right? You're a fund manager. You're a fund manager before you're an investor. There are a lot of GPs that have no idea how to do portfolio modeling.
Oh, wow.
They have no idea. They don't know how to do portfolio construction. They don't know how, like, if I go like, hey, what is, like.
I would worry, how are they handling the financial model
exactly,
of a startup?
Right? Like,
If they can even do portfolio, it's a bit of a different asset.
If you go to a founder and a founder goes like, oh, I've never thought about financial projections before. And you're like, what? Like, it doesn't have to be accurate. I'll give you that. It doesn't have to be accurate, but I should know what assumptions go on in this so I can kind of know how you think. But if you've never done it, if you don't think about doing it while you're pitching, it's like, what the hell is going on?
How are you going to use my money?
That's a red flag. And also, obviously, like lying, saying things, stretching the truth that, you know, don't really exist, because most sophisticated LPs do their reference checks, right? You'd be surprised the number of other GPs or founders that LPs are connected with. Like, there's an LP I chatted with, and he's like, every single, before he makes a GP investment, he will back channel at least 40 to 50 like people. I'm like, oh, this is, that's a lot. That's a lot.
Even more than a VC would have founder.
Even
sometimes.
More, right? And so they, because these are multi-decade long relationships, they want to talk to a bunch of folks. They want to like, so, and because of that, there's no point in stretching the truth because it'll eventually get found out. The last red flag I think I mentioned earlier is being unrealistic with expectations with TVPI, DPI, and IRR. Like, the benchmark for IRR for venture for the most part is 25%. If you have a vastly better than 25%, there I've questions, like, right? If it's like north of 50%, that's when you, like, between 25 and 50, that's fine, right? But if you have north of 50, that people start having questions, right? For TVPI, like, if you've invested in 2020, 2021, and you didn't preemptively mark down some of your portfolio companies, that's also worrisome, because then you have misleading expectations for where your next fund is going to go. Those are a couple of examples. There's many more, but I don't want to run listener, viewers' attention.
David, one last closing question. What's something that's currently emerging that excites you besides emerging LPs, obviously, because we've talked enough about them? Could be anything, a founder, a leader, a technology, an industry, whatever.
Okay, well, I thought of two things. The one, what is a founder? Founder I recently invested in, absolutely love him to death. I've also written about him recently, but Saba Karim at Faves. What I'm really excited about is, so I invest in social networks and social media. I just enjoy that. It's my bread and butter. That's my operating experience came from that as well.
You like risk.
I love risk. I mean, it's a hit-driven business. I love it, but I think I've made decent bets and I've got cash back. So that's like, I think I've made decent bets, right? I've gotten DPI. But the reason I'm really excited about Saba and Faves in particular is most social networks in general are always tooting like, hey, you know what? Here's X number of followers, Y number of like subscribers you have. It's always about the number of friends you have. If you're not Facebook friends, you're not Facebook official.
External,
right?
Validation.
External, a lot of external validation. But the truth is, like, we have an $8 billion person planet, right? But the average person, especially in metropolitan society, are, like, you know, feels a lot lonelier despite having so many people around them. And it's not the followers, not the subscribers. I hear all these stories, like these influencers go to conventions. They're like, oh, I'm doing a book signing event for my Instagram follow. No one shows up. And anyways, what Saba is building at Faves is not to have 200 million people following you or whatever it is. It's to have 200 people in your inner circle or 100 people in your inner circle who you can rely on. And his whole thing is like, how do you make your close friends closer? How do you actually feel like you're a friend and you're not just hanging that title of having a friend and like just like on LinkedIn people hang the title of being an LP angel, whatever it is, right? And he's built mechanisms in place to help people become closer. And I find that to be very fascinating. So it was very, like, easy investment. His previous kind of like operating experience has lent itself very well to thinking very deeply on it. But that, and as well as in general, I like hosting social experiments outside the world of venture. And you know that as well. But it's all about how do you help the world feel a little closer, a little smaller, and a lot more meaningful? And are there scalable things we can do? And are there unscalable things we can do? So what I'm doing with social experiments is very unscalable. Saba is doing something that's very scalable.
David, that's all. I appreciate the time. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I mean, I've been so excited about this. I've been looking forward to it. This whole, like, we've got the unicorn. I don't know if people can see. There's a unicorn here. There's like, if you're listening on a podcast, I'm sorry, you can't see this, but there's this monk. I love it. It's such a great setup. I love little gimmicks here and there. There's so much personality here. I love you as a person. Enzo, you're great. So thank you for having me.
Thanks, David. Really means a lot to have you one of the first episodes. So that's all. Thanks, folks. Thanks for joining us.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.